This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Monthly lecture series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It, making this valuable information available to the entire community. Tune in, turn on, and remember, we'll air Tuesday, January 29th, at 6 p.m. Hear Sharon Wood Wortman share memories as a volunteer KBOO reporter in the 80s. If you have a story to share from KBOO's past, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the Weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, activists occupy the local sheriff's office in Portland to try to stop evictions.
More updates from the second week of the Mohammed Mohammed trial in Portland.
Portland police come under fire for not using a mental health hotline set up to help them deal with crises. Good evening. 11 people occupied the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office overnight, including a local pastor, to call for a moratorium on foreclosure evictions. The sheriff agreed to meet with the protesters this afternoon and announced a settlement had been reached around 2 p.m. Although the settlement does not include a moratorium on evictions, it does address some of the concerns of protest organizers. The overnight action followed a protest yesterday in which 100 people stormed the sheriff's office and staged a sit-in. It came a week after the Austin family was forcibly evicted from their home of 27 years by the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, despite having made their mortgage payments. The officers waited until Ron Austin had gone to work at 5 a.m., when Debbie and her two children were alone, then entered the home to forcibly evict the family at the demand of the publicly owned and funded mortgage regulator Fannie Mae. Reporter Jamie Partridge was there when the occupiers emerged from the sheriff's office this afternoon and brings us their voices.
So when we started with a rally yesterday, we did not think that we would spend the entire night in the sheriff's department. We thought we might get arrested, but we didn't actually think we'd be camping in his office. And thanks to folks who brought us food and support and texts and emails, we very much needed all that awesome support. And we are really excited because we were able to be a part of a much bigger fight. Last week, Debbie was evicted. She was able to join us yesterday in starting our demand. And we were able to carry forward her demand over the last 20 hours. We know that ultimately there's a huge responsibility of this crisis. The decisions for foreclosure and eviction that are driven by banks, equity firms, and groups that are throwing people out of their houses for profit. And the heart of our fight is with them. The heart of our fight is to come out and stand with people at their homes. The heart of our fight is to bring power to bear on the banks that are evicting folks. But we hope that we've also moved the fight forward a little bit in the last 20 hours in a meaningful way to start to push back on the other ways that people are evicted and thrown into the streets. Over the last hour or so, we've been sitting down and talking with both the sheriff and the county commission about ways that we can start to halt the evictions of folks across this county. So we haven't got all the way there. we did not with one 20-hour period win a moratorium, but that fight continues. The fight to stop all evictions continues, and that fight will involve taking on and bringing this issue to judges across the state, to holding accountable the banks for the fraud and the ways that they have not followed even their own process in these foreclosures.
That was local foreclosure activist Angela McGlain, who spent the night upstairs in the sheriff's office. Reverend John Swivert, who also occupied the sheriff's office over the night, listed the crowd's demands to Multnomah County Chairman Jeff Cogan.
In our conversations, we heard that both the sheriff and the chair of the county commission, Jeff Cogan, care about the fact that homes are being foreclosed upon. And they've said that they want to work with us. Well, we're going to put that to the test because we're going to put our energy into working with them too. But we have asked them as an indication, sort of a demonstration of their willingness to do this, to answer three specific questions before you so you can hear the answers. First question is, knowing that you and we have work to do together to make it happen, will you, Sheriff Staten and Commissioner Cogan, publicly support the concept of halting foreclosure evictions?
Hi everyone, I'm Jeff Cogan. Sheriff Staten's not here because he has already started working on ways that we can make things better by meeting with the presiding judge. The presiding judge has the possibility of providing more flexibility for evictions, and that's what is happening right now. Do I support the idea, and does the sheriff support the idea that when we can work to get the laws changed so that we can get a moratorium, will we push to get that moratorium, will we support a moratorium? And the answer is yes.
Can I just say we hope that there's a possibility that the evictions can stop before all that work gets done. We think it may be able to. We're working for that. Okay, the second question is, will you, Sheriff Staten and Commissioner Jeff Cogan, convene a meeting as soon as possible with Judge Waller to temporarily delay orders for foreclosures and evictions?
And again, the answer is yes. That's where the sheriff is right now, meeting with the presiding judge.
And the third question is for Sheriff Staten, and he's given permission for Commissioner Cogan to answer for him. Will you, Sheriff Staten, back off from the use of unnecessary force and personnel when evicting families and put personnel resources instead into pursuing foreclosure fraud and irregularities?
So what the sheriff has said is that he is going to be personally attending evictions to make sure that there is no excessive force used, and he's going to be there at the evictions to make sure that's the case. Also, the sheriff and I both agree that we need to go after the possibility that there is fraud in these foreclosures. That's something that's going to involve bringing into the conversation the district attorney, but that's something that we're willing to pursue as well, and we're eager to pursue.
Those were the sounds of a rally this afternoon at the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office in Southeast Portland, where protesters managed to reach a settlement that will partially address the problem of people losing their homes in foreclosure evictions in the Portland area.
A Florida man has found a loophole in a state law that has allowed him to take possession of a multi-million dollar home that he never owned. Andre Loki Barbosa, a Brazilian native, took possession of a mansion located in Boca Raton, Florida, last July, using a process called adverse possession. The process uses an obscure property law that allows a person to acquire a property without money. According to state law, if someone occupies a home for 7 years, it becomes possession of the occupant if no one else claims the property title. The home was owned by Bank of America and is valued at $2.5 million. Bank of America foreclosed on the property in July of 2012, shortly before Barbosa filed his claim of adverse possession. Bank of America was notified by Palm Beach County Property Appraiser's Office. Barbosa placed a sign in the window claiming he is the, quote, living beneficiary to the divine estate, being superior of commerce and usury. A copy of the adverse possession paperwork was also posted in the window. When police tried to evict him the day after Christmas, Barbosa showed the officers a copy of the adverse possession claim, and the police backed down and did not evict him from the home.
The Portland Mercury this week exposed the Portland police's failure to use the mental health hotline specifically set up to help them deal with the crisis situations. Following a year-long review, the U.S. Justice Department announced in late 2012 that it found the Portland police had a pattern of excessive use of force against mentally ill suspects. The city agreed to implement a number of changes to help address the problem of excessive use of force by the Portland police. But as the Mercury reports, the police do not use the mental health resources that are already available to them. Spending millions more of city dollars may not help the situation, according to the authors of the report. The Portland Police Department responded to the report by listing some of the reasons why they haven't brought people in mental health crises to the center set up for police to use for that purpose. According to the police, the Crisis Assessment and Treatment Center, or CATC, does not accept drop-offs like Hooper Detox does for drunk people. The police say it's too much trouble to call the center first before dropping someone off. But the head of the CATC told Mercury reporters that they can handle mental health crises with advance notice from the police.
We're now in the second week of the trial of local teen Mohammed Mohammed, and KBU News continues its live coverage from the federal court in Portland. Mohammed is charged with trying to blow up the Christmas tree lighting ceremony at Pioneer Courthouse Square. His attorneys argue that he was entrapped by FBI agents who spent more than a year trying to convince the 18-year-old to engage in violence. KBU's Joe Meyer is at the courthouse. He joins us live for an update.
Hi, Liam.
Hi, Joe. What new information did we learn today about the first meeting between Mohammed and the undercover FBI agent?
Well, it was interesting. The government called FBI agent Mario Galindo to the stand. Agent Galindo had been with the FBI since 1998, started in narcotics, and then had been a tech agent in Portland since 2002. And he was the electronic surveillance specialist in charge of wiring up FBI undercover agent Youssef for that all-important first meeting with the defendant on Friday, July 30th, 2010. Youssef was equipped with a transmitter as well as a recording device. The transmitter allegedly worked, allowing FBI case agent Chan, who was also at the hotel, to listen in and take notes, and the recording device allegedly failed. On direct examination from the government, Agent Galindo testified that he had tested the recording device the day before and must have accidentally left the device on, draining the battery. He reported that he first learned that the recording failed on the following Monday morning, August 2nd. Now, upon cross-examination by public defender Steve Sadie, Agent Galindo seemed to modify the story. He testified that the recording device was actually turned off when he put it in its case on the evening of the 29th, the evening before the meeting. The FBI electronics specialist suggested that the recording device must have somehow turned itself on in transit while in its plastic case. Public defender Sadie also called into question the FBI timeline. Agent Galindo knew that the recorder failed on the morning of August 2nd, 2010. He reported this immediately to his supervisor, while previously Agent Chan, the guy listening in via Agent Youssef's working transmitter, testified earlier that he destroyed his notes on August 3rd, and he didn't find out much later until the recorder failed. So there's some kind of, again, siloing of information with the FBI, and it seems plausible. However, you know, I'm not sure what kind of evidence that was. So that's what we learned about that first meeting where the recorder did not work.
So the prosecution began to call civilian witnesses?
Yeah, most of the witnesses are, all the witnesses so far called by the government were FBI. And today, after we heard from Agent Galindo, the government called a few of Mohammed's college friends from OSU. They recounted for the prosecution that they drove up with the defendant from Corvallis on Thanksgiving Day 2010. That's the day before the Christmas tree lighting fake bomb scare. And that the defendant seemed to be his usual happy self. And after Thanksgiving dinner, they all went shopping at the Woodburn Mall. The friends also testified that on the morning of November 26th, Mohammed kept asking them if they were going to go back to Corvallis, or are you going to go right back to Corvallis? He asked them several times. Presumably, this was presented as evidence that the defendant was serious about the bomb and wanted to make sure his friends were safe. Now, on cross-examination, we learned that both of Mohammed's friends were Christian, calling into question the idea that he was a religious extremist. In a testimony of one of his college friends, Mr. Martinez, provided maybe the most poignant moment of the trial so far. As a reminder now, Mr. Martinez was the college friend who set up a summer job for Mohammed in Alaska, a summer fishing job. When Mohammed tried to board the plane to get to Alaska, he found out that he was on the no-fly list. He was interviewed by the FBI, and it seemed like the die was cast at that point. Again, on cross-examination, Mr. Martinez recounted his close friendship with the defendant, studying together, singing, dancing, and supporting each other, kind of typical college friends. And for the first time in the trial, the defendant, Mohammed, showed emotion, breaking into tears, presumably for the path not taken.
So yeah. What about the rest of the trial today?
The rest of the trial today saw the government call another FBI agent, Specialist Jeremy Springer. I don't know why these guys are all special agents, but they all seem to be special agents. He was a computer forensic specialist, and Agent Springer searched the defendant's computer. His testimony was really largely repetitive of earlier testimony. We just kind of got to see it from the digital perspective. And we got to, again, see the kind of inflammatory images from the jihad recollections. He also found on Mohammed's hard drive videos of Pioneer Square tree lighting ceremonies from previous years. Now, the defense kept on objecting to showing this, saying it was more prejudicial than probative. It was just going to be a very emotional thing to show. The judge allowed it, and we saw Tom Potter dressed up as Santa Claus in a packed and festive Pioneer Square. Agent Springer further testified for the government that the word jihad appeared on the defendant's computer 2,430 times, and the word bomb 8,091 times. On cross-examination, it came out that these references came from an MSNBC feed, and that there were zero references to bomb making. So,
very quickly, we're just about out of time. What's next?
Next, I think we have more expert witnesses, and of course the exciting part is when the defense starts to call witnesses, which probably will happen sometime next week.
All right. Thank you, Joe. We've been speaking with KABU reporter Joe Meyer, reporting live from outside the federal courtroom in Portland, where Mohammed Mohammed faces possible life in prison if found guilty of terrorism charges.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tune in for a conversation on using racially and culturally responsive education to ensure that every student receives the same opportunities. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for some spectacular rainy showers with temperatures in the 40s through the weekend.
It's 5:19. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Last year, Sheriff Tommy Gage of Montgomery County, Texas, was eager to show off his new surveillance toy. Having been given a $300,000 Homeland Security grant by the federal government, his office had become the first police agency in the nation to have its very own drone, a pilotless aircraft to monitor and, yes, spy on people. This beauty came with a deluxe eye-in-the-sky package, including infrared detection equipment and a power zoom camera. Filled with pride, the sheriff summoned the media to a big photo op last March to witness him and the drone strutting their stuff. To add drama to this show of police power, Gage also had his SWAT team attend in full riot regalia, positioning them in their Bearcat, an armored vehicle. The ground controller launched the pilotless aircraft as the sheriff beamed. But the demonstration went horribly wrong. Coming in for a landing, the high-tech Marvel suddenly went on the fritz, losing contact with the controller. Not only did it crash in front of the startled media, but even more startling to Sheriff Gage, it crashed right into his SWAT squad's Bearcat. Luckily, the armored vehicle held up, so none of the SWAT teamers were injured. But what a show! For one thing, the photo op showed that if the American people don't stop the reckless rush by the police industry complex to deploy thousands of domestic drones in the next few years, all of us had better be shopping for Bearcats to drive. This is Jim Hightower saying, in case you're also concerned that these spy machines will crash into our Constitution and be used to invade our privacy rights, Sheriff Gage says not to worry. No matter what we do in law enforcement, somebody's going to question it, grumps the Lone Star Sheriff. But we're going to do the right thing, and I can assure you of that. How assured does that make you feel?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A federal court in Virginia sentenced ex-CIA analyst John Kiriakou to more than 2 years in prison this morning for revealing the name of a covert agent. Kiriakou was the first federal agent to speak publicly about the Bush administration's torture program. Transparency and human rights advocates have criticized the Obama administration for prosecuting federal employees like Kiriakou, while at the same time pardoning those responsible for the crimes they expose. FSRN's Alice Olstein spoke to Kiriakou and his attorney this week and filed this report.
In his last public appearance before being sentenced Friday, John Kiriakou reflected on his crime and its punishment.
So I head to prison, accepting responsibility for my actions and hoping that maybe the country is better and more informed and more transparent for the debate that I helped to initiate. I'm sorry for the pain that I've caused my family, which has been considerable. But I believe that when people see something that's wrong and cruel and unjust and undemocratic, that they have to step up and say something about it.
In 2007, 3 years after leaving the CIA, Kiriakou gave an interview on ABC in which he became the first officer to confirm the Bush administration was using torture, including waterboarding, on detainees, and that it was policy rather than the work of a few rogue agents. Kiriakou told FSRN he felt he had to speak out because the environment at the CIA did not encourage employees to report wrongdoing.
It was very aggressive. It was just so militant and militaristic that no, you couldn't. If you weren't a part of the solution, you were part of the problem inside the CIA after September 11th. It was unspoken, but it was clearly out there.
The federal government spent more than 5 years building a case against him, finally charging him under the Espionage Act. Now, under a plea deal, the government is dropping those charges and convicting Kiriakou of violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. Attorney Jeslyn Radak, a former whistleblower herself who represents Kiriakou in this case, filed briefs saying the charges against him were selective and vindictive, but her motions were denied. And Kiriakou was sentenced Friday morning to 30 months in federal prison.
Hundreds of people were involved in the torture, and none of them have been prosecuted, nor will they be, because Obama gave them blanket immunity at the beginning of his term. Not only have they not been punished, they've been glorified, they've been promoted, and everyone has seen their career advanced, while John Kiriakou is the only person in the entire torture debacle who is going to jail, and he didn't torture anyone.
Radak works with the Government Accountability Project. She said while federal insiders routinely give information to reporters, the Justice Department never prosecutes the leaks that make the government look good.
All these so-called leak prosecutions are for things that embarrassed the government at best, and at worst, exposed war crimes.
Despite the president's emphasis on transparency and accountability, his administration has charged 6 federal employees under the Espionage Act, including Kiriakou. According to the Project on Government Oversight, that's more than all past presidents combined. Some of the cases, like the one against NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake, fell apart and didn't result in a conviction. Others, like FBI translator Shammai Leibowitz, have gone to prison for releasing information to the press. And Kiriakou and others were subjected to a long and invasive investigation and the constant monitoring of their activities.
I was under surveillance again yesterday. They followed me to the CVS and to the doctor's office and then back home again. It's just become a fact of life. I think it's meant to intimidate rather than to gather information.
Transparency advocates applauded last year's passage of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, which aims to protect federal workers who expose corruption and wrongdoing. But Bea Edwards with the Government Accountability Project says she's skeptical after watching the 1989 whistleblower bill get watered down in its implementation.
The courts over time made these increasingly restrictive rulings so that they created loopholes in the law that made it toothless.
Over the past few months, high-profile open government activists, including Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, have pressed President Obama to pardon Kiriakou or commute his sentence. But Kiriakou says he has little hope of this happening, and he wants his children to know that he paid his debt to society. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Great Britain, two members of the hacktivist group Anonymous will face jail time. Christopher Weatherhead and Ashley Rhodes were convicted of crashing the websites of PayPal, MasterCard, and others. PayPal alone lost $5.6 million as a result. The attacks were in response to those financial institutions blocking donations to WikiLeaks, a website known for posting classified documents online. Anonymous is a loose collection of online activists who address internet censorship and other social issues. Weatherhead received an 18-month sentence in prison. Rhodes received a 7-month sentence, already served. Peter Gibson, another member of the group, was given a suspended sentence of 6 months. And a fourth defendant, Jake Birchall, will be sentenced at a later date.
Vice President Joe Biden traveled to Richmond, Virginia today to hold a roundtable event on the administration's efforts to reduce gun violence. His visit comes a day after Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced a federal assault weapons ban, starting a contentious debate on the federal legislation. Biden spoke with the public about the ban in an online video chat.
Police organizations overwhelmingly support it because they get outgunned. They are outgunned on the street by the bad guys and the proliferation of these weapons.
Feinstein's bill would ban the sale, transfer, manufacturing, and importation of military-style semi-automatic rifles and high-capacity magazines that carry more than 10 rounds. It lists 157 types of weapons that would be banned. It excludes more than 2,000 models of guns that would still be legal for hunting and sporting. The path to becoming law is fraught with challenges, as Republican and some Democratic lawmakers have criticized it. The powerful NRA lobby has vowed to fight its passage.
Apple is no longer the world's richest company. That coveted spot is now occupied by ExxonMobil, which generates yearly revenues of over $350 billion. After iPad and iPhone losses caused Apple stock to falter, Exxon has once again become the world's most valued company. Exxon held the number one position from 2005 until 2011, when Apple first surpassed the oil company. The two companies went back and forth as the richest and second richest companies in the fall of 2011, but Apple has kept the number one position since early 2012. Some analysts question whether Apple can keep growing by releasing new versions of old products. Apple hasn't released a new product since the iPod hit the market in 2010.
The U.S. Senate passed two reforms Thursday night aimed at reducing partisan gridlock. While President Obama praised the rule changes as a positive step, lawmakers from both parties remain critical. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's James Helmsworth has more.
The Senate's new rules limit filibusters on motions to proceed to 4 hours, which could allow Congress to begin debating bills more quickly. The resolution, crafted by leaders from both major parties, also included a 2-year guarantee allowing the Republican minority a minimum number of amendments to any legislation. Yet the reforms fall short of the changes some political accountability groups desired. Common Cause, which is currently suing the Senate for its use of the filibuster, called this compromise bill a capitulation. Many Democrats have also been calling for more sweeping reforms, citing several bills, like the DREAM Act, that were killed by the filibuster. One proposed plan would have reinstated the talking filibuster, in which senators must speak on the floor to block a vote on a bill. Another proposal would have made it significantly more difficult for a filibuster to be sustained. A handful of Senate Republicans voted against the deal, claiming it will disempower the minority. James Helmsworth, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Water used to clean up the damaged Fukushima nuclear power plant may be dumped into the ocean. The Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, seeks government approval to drain partially decontaminated water into the Pacific Ocean. The water is used to cool the nuclear reactors damaged after the earthquake and tsunami in 2011. TEPCO will use a decontamination process that can remove most radioactive materials, but not all. To reach legally permissible levels of contamination, they will further dilute the water before discharging it into the ocean. Water cooling the reactors is usually recycled and used again as a coolant, but with 400 tons of groundwater used daily, TEPCO officials fear they'll soon run out of storage capacity.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Mel Jett, Sean Stewart, Quinn Reed, and David Coyle. The producer is Zeke Harrington. Special thanks to Joe Myers and the reporters at Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Keegan Heron.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott interview journalist Steven Rosenfeld. His recent articles on Alternet about guns and the IRA include The Surprising Unknown History of the NRA, include The Surprising Unknown History of the NRA. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15,